Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There has been another arrest in last week's bus and train bombings in London. The first suspect was arrested in Leeds. This time, the arrest was in Egypt. Joining us from London with more is Kim Samgupta. He's a correspondent for the British newspaper The Independent. And Kim, just who was arrested?
Well, this is quite a significant development. It's an Egyptian biochemist called Magdi Mahmoud El Nasher. Now, what's interesting is that he was arrested in Cairo. So this is the first evidence of an international dimension to the bombings in London. He lived in Leeds, the same area where three of the four bombers came from.
In fact, El Nasher had just completed his PhD in chemistry at the University of Leeds and was seeking a postdoctoral position. Why were authorities looking for him?
Well, he is said to have at some stage access to a flat where the police investigating the London bombing came across a bath full of explosive ingredients. His name had also come up repeatedly as an acquaintance of some of the alleged bombers.
And is it known that these explosives were explosives that were used in the attack?
Well, we don't know that they were of the type used in the attack. They needed to be mixed with other ingredients to turn them into bombs. Mm-hmm. But whether or not they were the actual explosives, we have yet to find out.
Yeah, we understand that FBI agents here in the States, in Raleigh, North Carolina, were also in the search for El Nasher because he was a former grad student at North Carolina State University, and they were putting together records in anticipation that they'd be contacted by the FBI, which sort of implies that this information was out, that people were hunting for him. Were you aware, as a reporter, that he was being sought?
Well, the answer is no. There was it's rather strange that the police tried to guide journalists away from looking at Mr. El Nasher. I suppose their fear was that he mm-hmm. may get frightened and disappear. But whatever the reason, they were downplaying his importance until the news of the arrest broke in Cairo.
Well, and Mr. El Nasher has said that he was in Cairo on vacation. He's said, why would I leave all my belongings behind if I, had done anything wrong? But the Associated Press is quoting some unnamed sources as saying they actually captured him some days ago. What are you hearing in Britain about his capture?
Well, we're told it took place recently. Mm-hmm. What we do know is that he disappeared 3 days before the London bombings. He left very suddenly. The university at Leeds, where he was working, said he went missing from campus early July. What we do know is that he was doing some postgraduate research, which entitled him to £30,000 worth of regional government funding. And he has not accessed that. He did not take advantage of that, and he left very suddenly. Mm. Well, of course, as you know, Robin, he has been saying to police in Egypt that he had been there for a vacation, a 45-day vacation, and he intended to return to Leeds when that was over.
One last question. We heard yesterday that police in London were searching for a fifth suspect, potentially a mastermind who was shown on videotape meeting with the four bombers before they fanned out to their targets. Is this Mr. El Nasher? And if not, how's the search for that fifth suspect going?
You'll be slightly careful in talking about a mastermind. I think that's a bit of journalistic shorthand. Mm-hmm. They are looking for someone else, and that is based on CCTV footage which they have picked up at Luton. And there is a feeling that the bombers met someone at Luton who may have been part of the team. But whether he was this alleged mastermind or whether he was just another member of a support team, we don't know. Mm-hmm. Whether Mr. El Nasher is the mastermind or not, again, we do not know. Now, he's a qualified chemist, so I suppose one can put two and two together and perhaps come to the conclusion that that he helped to manufacture the bombs, but obviously at this stage there is no evidence of that.
Mm-hmm. No. But to my other question, is he the man on the tape? Do the pictures match, or do we not know?
We do not know, but the answer is almost certainly no, because the feeling is that he left the country three days before the bombings mm-hmm. took place. So unless that's wrong, he's unlikely to have been the man on the tape.
Mm-hmm. Kim Samgupta, defense correspondent for The Independent in Britain. Kim, before we let you go, any other developments you can tell us today?
No, we're still waiting to hear what happens with Mr. Al-Nashr. The only other thing is, you know, the authorities are looking very closely at the Pakistani connection. At least three of the bombers had spent time in madrasas in Pakistan, and the feeling is, you know, they are madrasas which were run by militant groups in Pakistan. One name being mentioned is a group called Jamaat-e-Islami. And there's also a suggestion, uncorroborated, I hasten to add, that Mr. Al-Nashr may too have gone to Pakistan to a madrasa, but that is something, you know, which we have got no evidence of at the moment.
Kim, thanks very much.
Pleasure.
There are more leaks in the case of Karl Rove today. A source close to the investigation into the outing of a CIA agent has reportedly told at least two news organizations that the White House Deputy Chief of Staff talked to columnist Robert Novak, as well as another journalist, before they wrote stories revealing the identity of Agent Valerie Plame. Plame, you'll remember, is the wife of Joseph Wilson, the former ambassador and strong critic of the Bush administration's use of faulty intelligence in the war in Iraq. There has been widespread speculation that Plame's name was leaked as retribution against Wilson. Well, to bring us up to speed on all of this is Linda Feldman, White House correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Linda, tell us, first of all, Rove's lawyer acknowledged last week that he spoke to Time magazine reporter Matthew Cooper. So in your reading of these reports, the two reporters that spoke to Rove, is Cooper one of them?
It's yes. I mean, we do know that mm-hmm. That Cooper and Rove spoke. Mm-hmm. But the new wrinkle that comes out today is that Karl Rove is the line that's being put out on Karl Rove is that he seemed to be kind of a passive receiver of information, and then he would passively confirm to someone else that Joe Wilson's wife worked for the CIA. So the implication seems to be that Rove was not intentionally and aggressively leaking classified information to the press.
Well, so we know that Rove's lawyer has said that he did, as you said, speak to Matthew Cooper and only named an agent, did not give Wilson's wife's name. So what is this new report of a conversation between Rove and Novak?
Well, what that does is it closes one of the loops. If you look at a kind of a flow chart of who has talked to whom and how people are related to each other in this case, there was never a clear line drawn between Rove and Novak. I mean, everyone assumes that they had communicated on this since they have a relationship going way back, and having background conversations on politics. But
in
now we
fact,
know that they had.
Mm-hmm. In fact, we should address that because early in the 90s, Karl Rove was fired by the first President Bush after accusations that he leaked to Robert Novak. Now, both Novak and Rove deny that, but that is part of their story.
That's right. This has been widely reported that Rove was fired by the first President Bush for leaking to Novak during the 92 campaign.
So what exactly does this new source say that Rove and Novak talked about?
Well, the new source is saying that Novak had called the White House to talk about something completely different, and then at the end of the conversation he asked him about Joe Wilson's wife, and reportedly, according to the sources that have been, you know, in today's papers, Rove said, you heard that. So there's some thinking that Novak was essentially, that this was confirming for Novak what he had heard elsewhere about Joe Wilson's wife.
And several days later, Robert Novak wrote his now infamous column naming Valerie Plame. So what is the speculation about this leak and the timing of it?
About which leak?
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. There's so many at this point. Today's reported leak of a source close to the investigation who now is saying that Karl Rove had a conversation with Robert Novak.
Right. Well, obviously the White House is spinning furiously. They know that this is bad for the president. Even if Karl Rove is never indicted, let alone convicted, it's bad for the White House when they have to appear on the defensive and the president is having to defend his top advisor. Mm. So that what they're trying to do is acknowledge some piece of this, acknowledge that, that at least that Novak had spoken to Rove, but that, there, that, that nothing untoward had happened in that conversation.
Well, in fact, columnists and editorial pages are having a field day with this topic with conflicting conclusions. Let's ask about one of the points that's being discussed. This week, the Wall Street Journal called Karl Rove the heroic whistleblower in this story, saying that he was warning reporters off of Joseph Wilson's claim that there was no evidence of Iraq buying uranium from Africa. And the journal points to the British Butler investigation, which said that the White House claim that there was evidence was well-founded. However, you turn to Frank Rich, writing in the New York Times. He says Wilson was telling the truth. Frank Rich points to Mohammed Baradei, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, which came to the conclusion that the uranium claim was based on false evidence. Each writer conveniently leaves out the fact that opposes their thinking. So what is true about the claim of the at the heart of this, whether or not Iraq was buying uranium from Africa?
I think the bottom line is that we don't know. I went back and looked at the reporting on the Butler report that came out a year ago, which said it cited that it did indeed say that the that this notion that Iraq was seeking to buy uranium in Africa was well founded, but that was based on what was known in 2002. Mohammed al-Baradei of the IAEA is speaking more recently. I think the White House's conclusion on this still stands, which is that it should not have been in the State of the Union address because they could not conclude for sure that it was correct. We don't know if it's not true, but we don't know if it's true.
In fact, CIA Director George Tenet came out and said just that, that those famous 16 words claiming the uranium exchange should not have been in the speech, which some say point to what Joseph Wilson was saying. Well, what happens now?
Well, I think, well, there's two things. On the legal track, everybody needs to just calm down and wait for the legal process to proceed. The special prosecutor and the grand jury still have a lot of work to do. The grand jury will be in place for another 4 months, and so nobody should be calling for anybody to resign until we have some firm facts and conclusions on the legal front. However, politics will not allow that. There is a huge opportunity for the Democrats to discredit the White House and Karl Rove and really take major pot shots at this issue of honesty and credibility.
And just one last quick question, Linda. We just have a few seconds, but it occurs to us that this most recent story about Rove having a conversation with Novak is a grand jury leak. Does that mean there might be another investigation into who the sources were for the New York Times and AP stories?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, there's no, I don't think there's any possible violation of the law in these leaks. I mean, Patrick Fitzgerald can tell people not to talk to the press, but mm-hmm. If he wants to go after that, I suppose he could.
Oh,
but
boy.
It would be, hard for him to make any traction on that.
Right. Well, Linda, thank you so much.
Great. Thank you.
Linda Feldman, a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, on the latest news out of the Valerie Plame investigation. And in fact, the Cleveland Plain Dealer newspaper says that it put the brakes on two investigative stories in part because of the ramifications of the Plame investigation and Judith Miller, a reporter in that case, being sent to jail. We're going to hear more about whether this case is having a chilling effect on other investigative reporting. More coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we've been talking about the fallout of the Valerie Plame story. She's the CIA operative who was outed in the media after her name was leaked to the press, a special prosecutor now investigating because it's against the law to knowingly reveal an undercover agent. Well, New York Times reporter Judith Miller is in jail today for refusing to reveal her source in the story she was working on but never wrote about Plame. And Time magazine turned over reporter Matt Cooper's notes to the special prosecutor to avoid fines. Cooper eventually testified. This story is having a somewhat chilling impact on at least one newsroom. This week, the editor of the Cleveland Plain Dealer said he pulled two stories that relied on illegally leaked documents because he feared penalties against the paper and jail time for the reporters. Joining us on the line to talk about the impact of the story, we have Brant Houston, Executive Director of Investigative Reporters and Editors. It's a nonprofit that provides training to journalists. Welcome.
Hello.
And Manny Garcia, Metro Editor at the Miami Herald. Welcome to you as well, Manny.
Thank you.
And Manny, let's start with you first. The editor, Douglas Clifton, of the Cleveland Plain Dealer, is quoted as saying that he felt these stories were so important and the leaks so serious that there was sure to be an investigation of the leaks. And talking, naming their sources wasn't an option. Jail, too high a price to pay. So they pulled the stories. What was your reaction?
Well, Doug used to be my boss, and I have a great deal of respect for Doug, and Doug doesn't pull many punches. On our end, right now, we've been fortunate where we have not had a situation ready to publish a big piece where we've had to rely on anonymous sources. So we're not in that situation yet. We just had a meeting, I'd say about a week ago, among staffers and senior managers about how would we deal that when that situation comes around, because inevitably it will. I was thinking back to the 9/11 attacks when we relied extensively on law enforcement sources to get us information that normally we would not have been entitled to, and thinking if we would have been in that position now, we'd have a lot of discussions before we'd pull the trigger.
Well, Brent Houston, I want to ask you, going back to Douglas Clifton's comment, he again, the editor of the Cleveland Plain Dealer, and in his column explaining to readers why they were pulling two stories, he said, revealing a source isn't an option, and jail is too high a price to pay. It's not the reporters who feel it's too high a price to pay because the reporters are willing to go to jail. It's the companies that own these newspapers who feel it's too high a price to pay, and then that's a slippery slope.
It is. It is. And I think there are a lot of issues that have been coming up in the past decade is family-owned newspapers sold out to corporations. You get a lot more people involved who've never been in the news business who are either concerned about the finances or about laws from a different angle than the traditional news business has been.
Well, Manny, I want to ask you about those external forces, corporations who own media. Frank Rich of the New York Times writing about the Matthew Cooper Time Magazine case. Matthew Cooper's boss is, of course, at Time Magazine, gave up his notes. Frank Rich writes, Time Warner seems to have far too much money on the table in Washington to exercise absolute editorial freedom. They're awaiting FCC review of an acquisition of the cable company Adelphia so that they have a conflict of interest. And I'm wondering, watching from the sidelines as a reporter, what was your view of Time Magazine giving up a reporter's notes?
Well, I had a lot of problems with that. At the end of the day, it's maybe you've got the corporation deciding it's going to be too expensive to fight the good fight. We've never had that problem here. At no point has Knight Ridder ever sent that I've seen an edict saying, look, this is the way we're going to operate. If the government comes after us, we're going to turn notes over. And the Miami Herald as a company has always stood behind its reporters. Let me give you a quick example. Last year, the U.S. attorney here for the Southern District of Florida and two of his colleagues came into my office. And we were preparing to write a story about an investigation over at the airport. He believed or he knew we had grand jury leaks of information, and should we publish a story, our reporter would be subject to the possibility of being subpoenaed and called before a grand jury to testify about what he did. So this went up the chain, and again, lawyers and so forth, and we decided at the end of the day, we were going to publish a story because it was of great importance to our readers, and at no point did anybody worry about any effect. And, the reporter was, Joe Mazingo was ready to take his lumps if he needed to, and to protect his source.
Well, in fact, some newspapers are changing policy because of this fear. The L.A. Times editor has instructed all of his writers to never write down the name of a source in the computer in case his bosses, his corporate bosses, decide to submit to a subpoena and turn over computers. So I'm wondering, Manny, what's changed at all, if anything, in your newsroom?
Well, what's changed at all, we had a meeting, I want to say it was about a week ago, with the executive editor and our managing editor for news, and a lot of us came away, just two things came away from, well, you know what, if we're going to have an anonymous source, and it's not in policy, it's just a decision that was discussed among reporters, is saying, we're just not going to write this person's name down. Mm-hmm. The other point that really came up with is, look, you should always try to find a separate way of getting the information. You should not have to depend on an anonymous source. Is there a way that you can get information through the paper trail or just talk to people after they've come out of a grand jury? And, avoid anonymous sources as much as possible. For me, as a member of IRE, that's the IRE way.
Yeah, that's what we teach everyone. I mean, as an organization, we conduct about 60, 70 seminars a year. And that's exactly on point. Having been a practicing journalist in the middle of a newsroom for almost two decades, I learned early on, if you've got a really deep source, don't even write down the initials.
Well, Brent Houston, we began with the question, has this had a chilling effect? It certainly has at the Cleveland Plain Dealer, but what do you see more broadly?
I see more broadly what's happening at the Miami Herald, which is people are sitting down and reviewing their procedures and their policies and saying, okay, the climate has changed. How do we get through this climate and still do the great public service work that we should do? And will it slow things down at times? Will it cause people to think twice? Yes. Is that all bad? No. Will it have a total chilling effect? No. I think the one great thing about journalists is they are irascible, and if you tell them yes, they tend to say no. If you tell them no, they tend to say yes. And so there's a great energy among journalists to keep doing the good work.
That's Brent Houston, Executive Director for Investigative Reporters and Editors, a nonprofit group that provides support and training to journalists. We also spoke with Manny Garcia, Metro Editor at the Miami Herald. Well, stay with us because there is much more coming up, including Gene Wilder's response to the idea that there's a new Willy Wonka. It's all coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. At the stroke of midnight, muggles across the country will be able to crack open Book 6 of the Harry Potter series, Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. So too will muggles without sight. For the first time, blind readers will have a Braille edition of the Wizard's new Trials and Tribulations on the same day the print edition becomes available, which is quite an accomplishment. The Braille version of the Book 6 is 8 volumes and weighs in at 11 pounds, although it costs the same as the sighted version. Here now's Monica Brady-Meyerhoff has more.
One person in Boston has already read the latest Harry Potter book due out tomorrow. It's a transcriber at the National Braille Press, headquartered in Boston. Because of the high security around the book's release, we can't give her name, and we can't say exactly where the press is located. Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince is safely behind a locked door. Jeff, no last name please, is the production coordinator. He leads the way to the basement where the book is being collated and bound.
We're calling this the Chamber of Secrets because no one has been allowed down here who hasn't agreed to sign a non-disclosure agreement and swear that they will divulge nothing that they find out.
This is it. This is Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. But that's about all I can read because the rest is in Braille.
The National Braille Press has been working overtime for the past 2 weeks to print 350 copies, the only ones in the world available tomorrow. Eventually, it will print 800. That's not many compared with the 10.8 million copies printed for sighted readers, but it is huge to Braille readers, says Bill Rader, president of the National Braille Press.
Children across the country are all excited. Do we want to leave blind children out of that? No. Blind children get left out of enough things, and the more that we can keep them into the mainstream with their sighted peers, the better.
This will be the first book in the Harry Potter series to be released on the same day as the sighted version. 17-year-old Erica Costa from Somerset is like millions of other Harry Potter fans who want to read the book as soon as it's released, and now she can.
I'm psyched. I just can't wait to find out what happens, because I've read every single book in the series.
Costa, a student at Perkins School for the Blind in Watertown, lost her sight about 7 years ago because of an illness.
When you're reading it, I don't know about anybody else, but I like reading in the dark so my mind can go all over the place when I'm reading. And my mind can picture the action, what's going on as I'm reading it.
So you turn off the lights to read Harry Potter?
Yeah.
Even though you're blind?
Mm-hmm. I just work better in the dark.
Often blind people will listen to audio versions, but listening to a book on tape is not the same as reading it in Braille, say many blind people, including 17-year-old Krista Pinnell, who's been blind since birth.
Your mind is more active. You're thinking more about what you're reading because you don't have to really listen to it. You can look at it. Just like, you know, if you had a print book in front of you, you could look at it the same as we would.
The National Braille Press tried to get other Harry Potter volumes in advance of the publication, but author J.K. Rowling had placed tight restrictions on Scholastic, so it wouldn't release it. For that reason, blind people had to wait months for the Braille edition. Printing in Braille is a long, detailed process that begins with a transcriber, such as Rebecca at the National Braille Press.
On the screen, what I see as a transcriber is just the print version, and it's laid out on the page where I want it to be laid out in the Braille, because I've put codes in there that tell it where to go. And then I have the computer do the translation for me, and it pops it into Braille.
Rebecca, we can't tell you her last name, says Harry Potter proved especially difficult to transcribe because of one character's name.
Her name is Hermione, and it wants to contract it like Hermione. Like the word phone, you use the O-N-E contraction because it's all in one syllable.
Contractions in Braille are like shorthand. They're critical because they conserve space on the page. Jeff explains that once the book has been transcribed into Braille and proofread, it comes to this room.
They bring it in to these devices on a disc, just a 3.5-inch floppy. And this machine punches it out on a zinc plate. And I think it's the most amazing part of the process. It can punch double-sided on one plate without the holes canceling each other out. 5,900 capable dots on each side of a page, and none of them ever touch.
There is a lot of proofreading along the way, but for the Harry Potter book, they sped up the process by using Jiffy Braille, which means proofreading only for missing or extra dots. The extra wide pages are embossed on print presses that were retrofitted for Braille. It can print on both sides of a page. Still, books in Braille are about double the size of print books.
This is 7 of the 13 volumes.
Judy Cannon, a Braille services specialist at the Perkins School, has her arms full with The Order of the Phoenix, the fifth in the series. She explains a person reading Braille reads left to right, scanning their hands across the page instead of their eyes. Cannon demonstrates.
Chapter 35, By the Veil, continued. It seemed to have worked. They streaked after him, knocking
the Harry Potter series is the press's best-selling series in Braille. The Half-Blood Prince is 1,048 pages, divided into 8 manageable volumes. Stacked on top of each other, it stands almost 2 feet high. Krista Pinnell says she'll zip through it.
I read pretty fast.
If you were in a competition of Harry Potter reading, who would win? The sighted person or you?
Probably me, because sighted people have, like, other distractions. Like, they can be reading and talking on the phone at the same time, or reading and watching TV at the same time, or, you know, just nonsensical things like that, and we can't really do that.
Harry Potter costs about $62 to produce, but the National Braille Press, which is a nonprofit, is selling it for $17.99, the same as the sighted version costs pre-ordered online. The press wants parity for blind readers, and after 5 books and 8 years, they finally got it with Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince.
That's Here Now's Monica Brady Meyerhoff. And this update on a story we've been following, a federal appeals court put the Bush administration's military commissions for terrorist suspects back on track today, saying a detainee at the Guantanamo Bay prison who once was Osama bin Laden's driver can stand trial. The Associated Press further reports that a 3-judge panel ruled 3-0 against Salim Ahmed Hamdan, whose case was halted by a federal judge on grounds that commission procedures were unlawful. The protections of the 1949 Geneva Convention do not apply to Al-Qaeda and its members, so Hamdan does not have a right to enforce its provisions in court, was the conclusion of the appeals court judges. And as always, we welcome your thoughts on anything on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. And please remember to tell us how to pronounce your full name and the town you're from. Well, still to come, the long, strange journey of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, from Gene Wilder as the Candyman to Johnny Depp as Michael Jackson. You're listening to Here and Now. When it was first released in 1971, it was a dud, but it has turned into a cult favorite, a milk dud, if you will. Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory starred Gene Wilder as the reclusive candy man who reluctantly opens the doors of his factory to several children and their parents.
My dear friends, you are now about to enter the nerve center to the entire Wonka factory. Inside this room, all of my dreams become realities. And some of my realities become dreams. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, the chocolate room.
Critics hated the movie version of Roald Dahl's children's book. Even today, Ty Burr of the Boston Globe says Willy Wonka has the feel of a TV pilot for a child's first acid trip. But children fell in love with Wonka. Recently, Gene Wilder told us he made one request of director Mel Stewart before taking the part. In his first entrance in the film, he insisted on walking with a cane.
I said, I'd like to walk out of the factory, and all the crowd is waiting out there, and I'm limping, and I'm walking with a cane. And the crowd starts to quiet down. Oh, my gosh, he's crippled. Who thought Willy Wonka was crippled? My goodness. Till they're all quiet. Then my cane gets stuck into a brick, and I keep going and then realize I don't have my cane, and I do a forward somersault and jump up, and they all applaud. And Mel Stewart said, what do you want to do that for? And I said, because from that time on, no one, not the audience and not the kids, will know whether I'm lying or telling the truth all through the rest of the movie. And he said, oh, you come out of the door, you're walking around, and get stuck in the ground. Okay, I'll do it. And I wouldn't have done the part, because although it was a good part, that element was missing of the lying. I like to lie, but it's not just because I like to lie. The character of Willy Wonka played such tricks on everyone, and you didn't know whether he was lying or telling the truth, and I wanted to set that up at the very beginning, first entrance.
Well, now, over 30 years later, there's a new version of the film, director Tim Burton's Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. But can there possibly be a Wonka that's not Wilder? When we spoke, it had just been announced that Johnny Depp had been cast in the role, and we asked Gene Wilder what he thought about that.
About Johnny Depp creating the part of Willy Wonka, right. I feel wonderful. And if I were directing, he's the one I would cast. Christopher Walken would have been very good.
Oh, he'd be so scary.
He'd be scary. And Johnny Depp has magic and mystery, and that's what's required. However, if I had been asked, I would have said, first make a remake of The Wizard of Oz. And when you're finished with that, then tackle Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. No. I don't approve of it.
You don't?
No, I don't. No, I don't like messing with things that are already perfect in the way they are. However, to give them a little credit, Tim Burton, who did Beetlejuice and Edward Scissorhands and Batman, and he's not going to do the Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory that I did. I think it'll be a much scarier film, and, well, we'll see.
Well, to some of us, you will always be Willy Wonka.
Thank you.
That cannot be tampered with. Gene Wilder speaking a while back about the new version of the classic Willy Wonka tale, which has just been released. And I'm not alone in my opinion. Here now, critic Steve Almond, your first reaction when hearing that there was going to be a remake of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Oh, God, no. Please, don't do this.
How many times have you seen the original?
Many, many, many times. In the high 20s.
And you say it's one of the great films ever made.
Yes, I say it, and I only say it because it is true. What drives the original Willy Wonka is that you just want to spend time with Willy Wonka.
You can't take your eyes off
him. You cannot take your eyes off him. He is fascinating. And that all resides, I should say, some of that's in the book, but a lot of that is Gene Wilder's brilliance as an actor. And this is no knock on Johnny Depp as an actor. He's a fine actor. There's no real interest either in the kids or in candy for that matter.
That's Steve Almond, also author of the book Candy Freak and a candy man in his own right. We're going to hear more from Steve about the new movie, but we're also going to hear from people who loved it when we come back. Stay with us, much more ahead, here and now.
Hold your breath. Make a wish. Count to three. Come with me and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look and you'll see into your imagination. We'll begin.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. When Tim Burton, the creator of The Nightmare Before Christmas and Edward Scissorhands, announced that he would be making his own film version of Roald Dahl's Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, there was some dismay. The 1971 film version starring Gene Wilder is considered a cult classic by some. So there's a lot of anticipation today as Tim Burton's film opens with Johnny Depp as Willy Wonka. It's the story of Charlie Bucket, who finds a golden ticket and, along with four other children and their guardians, is granted admission to Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory, where all sorts of amazing adventures and some scary teaching moments await. Here's what people thought at a preview this week.
Oh, I thought it was great. I saw the first one, and there were a lot of similarities, but at the same time, there were a lot of new twists, and it made me feel like a kid again.
I barely remember the first, kind of, because I was so young, but this was actually fabulous.
I like it really good. My favorite part was when the squirrel take off the peanut shells instead of the Oompa Loompas, and when the squirrel knocked on the girl's head and listened to it.
I actually like the first one a lot better, as kind of can't remake that movie.
Well, that's what many people think, including Wonka 1, Gene Wilder, and our literary critic Steve Ahman, who admits to seeing the first film over 20 times. Candy is Steve's expertise. He wrote the book Candy Freak, in which, Steve, you write that this highly secret world of Willy Wonka's factory is not that far from reality in some ways.
Yeah, in fact, Roald Dahl wrote Charlie and the Chocolate Factory partly based on the historical rivalry in England between Roundtree and Cadbury, two big chocolate companies that were around when he was a kid. I believe he worked for one of the chocolate companies as a kid. But at any rate, he certainly read all the news reports of espionage between the two companies, and that continues to this day. Ironically, though, it's, you know, makes candies that are supposed to be innocent and childlike, the confectionery industry is notoriously secretive.
Right, right. And, well, okay, so the book is Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. As we said, the first one was film was Willy Wonka, named after the candy maker. But now with the change in title, there's more focus on Charlie's family. Let's listen to a scene when Charlie talks about how hard it's going to be for him to win a ticket.
I only get one bar a year for my birthday.
But it's your birthday next week. You have as much chance as anybody does.
Balderdash. The kids are going to find the golden tickets are the ones who can afford to buy candy bars every day. Our Charlie gets only one a year. He doesn't have a chance.
Everyone has a chance, Charlie.
One of the great aspects of the book and both films is that it does really try to portray, which Hollywood films almost never do, the world of haves and have-nots. And, you know, it's a kind of typical underdog saga. You get a real pointed, concrete sense that this kid is poor. His family is really poor.
Right. And Tim Burton was adamant that screenwriter John August, who did the rewrite, not watch the 1971 film.
Yes. Now, do you know why that is?
Yeah.
Because he would have been shamed out of making a new one.
No, the reasoning was he wanted to adhere as closely to the book. So do you think the second one is closer to the book than the first?
They both take liberties. And the liberties that the new film takes, especially with the Willy Wonka character, are completely bonkers, have nothing to do with the character in the book.
Well, let's listen to a little of Johnny Depp's Willy Wonka before we go further. This is a scene with Violet, who's the chewing gum girl, we all remember, Veruca, the spoiled rich girl, the other two of the other children who get to go into the factory. They are introducing themselves to Willy Wonka.
Mr. Wonka, I'm Violet Beauregard.
Oh, I don't care.
Well, you should care, because I'm the girl who's going to win the special prize at the end.
Well, you do seem confident, and confidence is key.
I'm Veruca Salt. It's very nice to meet you, sir.
I always thought of Veruca was a type of wart you got on the bottom of your foot.
Johnny Depp, I think you can get a little flavor of that from the cut, is deeply creepy in this role. He is a cross between Michael Jackson and Mr. Rogers, and I mean that quite literally, leaning towards Jacko.
Because Mr. Rogers would not be, you know, parents would not respond negatively to that.
Right, but you can hear from the intonation of his voice his social awkwardness. I mean, Willy Wonka in the book and in the first film is happy to do this. He wants to welcome these kids into his world because he believes that children are the ones who will understand the way his mind works. They haven't been, their imaginations haven't been shut down by reality. And the new Willy Wonka, Johnny Depp, plays this, he's like this Oedipal wreck. They have this whole backstory about his father who was a tyrannical dentist. And it's the math, psychological math, is rudimentary and almost insulting and totally obvious. And he as a character, I hate to sound biased, but you know I am, is just, he has no charisma.
Well, and you have used the word creepy a couple of times. Some would say that the book, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, has some pretty grim, creepy scenes. I want to hear one of those scenes. This is where Veruca Salt, again, the spoiled little rich girl, demands that her daddy gets her one of those nutcracking squirrels. First of all, set the scene up for us a little more.
Sure. Well, this is Willy Wonka has trained a bunch of squirrels to inspect the nuts and open them that they're going to go into his candies. And so Veruca, of course, who wants everything, wants one of everything, demands that her father give her one of these squirrels who are very funny and lifelike. And that scene is an absolute riot. You heard the kid at the beginning talk about how much he liked that scene.
Daddy, I want a squirrel. Get me one of those squirrels. I want one.
All right, pet. Daddy will get you a squirrel just as soon as he possibly can.
But I don't want any old squirrel. I want a trained squirrel.
Very well. Mr. Wonka, how much do you want for one of these squirrels? Name your price.
But they're not for sale. She can't have one.
The Oompa Loompas, how do they fare? These are the little candy-making assistants.
Yes. Well, in the original film, they're played by little people. And in this film, they're a CGI-generated. There's just one guy, and he is replicated over and over again through the miracles of Hollywood technology. Let me say in defense of the new film, some of the sequences with this Oompa Loompa, who's replicated a zillion times, are very funny. Mm-hmm. Tim Burton has a great sense of the visual.
Augustus Gloop, Augustus Gloop, the great big greedy nincompoop. Augustus Gloop, so big and vile, so greedy, foul, and infantile. Come on, we cry, the time is right, the engine shooting up the pipe.
But don't, dear children, be alarmed.
Augustus Gloop will not be harmed. Augustus Gloop will not be harmed.
You can expect with the budgets they have now and all the modern technologies that the film, and Tim Burton, that the film is going to look beautiful and fascinating. It just has a weird, warped heart.
Mm. Steve Almond, who is a huge fan of the original Willy Wonka. But let me ask you this. If you hadn't seen Willy Wonka, the mm-hmm. original, would you like this movie more?
I think I would have liked it okay. I think what I would have thought is that they failed to capture the thing at the center of the book and the original film, which is a sense of children as a combination of wildly imaginative and innocent and hopeful about the world and really driven and selfish and self-interested. And that was what the original Willy Wonka and the book was really able to get at. The kids can be tremendously good and sort of restore our faith, and they can also break our hearts. I didn't get that sense at all with the new film. It was funny to look at. It had some good gags in it. And I must say also that it was just difficult to spend that much time with a character as unappealing as Johnny Depp's Willy Wonka. I think I would feel that regardless of Gene Wilder playing in my mind.
Okay.
And can I say one other thing, which is that the original film had such a, and this is, of course, coming straight from the Candy Freak, had such a reverence for candy. Candy is Willy Wonka's medium. It is the way he expresses his love for the world and his creative impulses. And that in the first film is so beautifully celebrated. In this version, you don't get a sense that Johnny Depp dreams in chocolate. You know, that he goes to sleep each night thinking about what he's going to create and how he can share it with the world.
Here now is literary critic Steve Almond, the author of Candy Freak, A Journey Through the Chocolate Underbelly of America. Charlie and the Chocolate Factory opens today. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.